And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. Here in mid-August of 2022, the global carbon dioxide levels are 417.92 parts per million, and there are roughly 2,702 days left until the year 2030. The clock keeps ticking. Well, here in Massachusetts, in New England, I should say, we date all the way back to the founding of our nation, when a day's ride on a horse seemed like a long way to go. And as it happened, way back in the days, a guy named Roger Williams was making too much trouble in Boston, and they basically gave him a passport to leave the state, and he took a couple days ride down to Rhode Island and established the state of Rhode Island, which is the tiniest state and the smallest state in the union, maybe the best state, but the smallest state, and it's right close to Massachusetts and is impacted in many ways similarly to Massachusetts in being in the New England region. Rhode Island has recently been making headway. So all the states in New England, very particularly Massachusetts and Rhode Island, are addressing the climate change question. The Rhode Island legislature recently started to take some steps to basically codify goals and make roadmaps and think about what the state has to do long term. And it's an interesting question to compare and contrast the Rhode Island plan to Massachusetts. How are they the same? How are they different? What do they have in common? All kinds of questions like that come up. To that end, we are thrilled to have with us today Larry Creshan, who is the executive director of a nonprofit called the Green Energy Consumers Alliance, which is remarkably multifaceted, does all kinds of important things, and comprehends the politics of both Rhode Island and Massachusetts. And so we wanted to get an update on what the heck's going on down in Rhode Island. Larry, welcome aboard. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Ted. Thank you for having me.
So that little story I gave about you and Green Energy Consumers Alliance in Rhode Island, did I get it more or less right? How would you correct it, or what should people know about?
You got it right. I'll just elaborate that our organization started 40 years ago in Boston, and in response to heating oil prices were rising, people banded together to try to deal with that. Always pro-consumer, not pro-oil. And then we worked for years. I was hired 23 years ago. And then around 2006, a group in Rhode Island called People's Power and Light formed, a separate nonprofit. And we merged with them. And so now we're Green Energy Consumers Alliance. And so we have an office in Boston, and we have an office in Providence. And so we run the same programs in both states, and the consumers can tap into. You can buy green electricity from us. We can help you get solar panels, heat pumps, electric vehicles, those sorts of things. We also advocate for state level policy, where we darken the doors of the state house and we ask legislators to adopt good energy policy. It's really important what happens mostly at the federal level, right? But that's not everything. And so we think we, as an organization, we've carved out a niche is trying to affect change at the state level.
And one of the many things that I'm familiar with that I think people can connect to pretty easily is something called the Shave the Peak program, where Green Energy Consumers Alliance will essentially send you a text if you sign up on really hot days. And so then you can turn down your electricity a little bit and try and reduce the demand on the hottest days, which in turn reduces carbon pollution from those dirty power plants they have to turn on. Is that program still underway?
It is. One of our, we hired an intern a couple of years ago, Kai Salem, who when she was at Brown University, along with two other students, they started a program on their own as a school project. And they started a program called Shave the Peak, where they would educate people and text people about how you can reduce demand at when the grid is at its most stressed. And it was very educational. And so we hired her, and then we hired her to work here full time. She was a great advocate. Sadly, she's going off to law school and she'll be a great lawyer. But the program now has thousands of subscribers. And we're trying to make the point that, you know, the government's moving too slowly. The utilities are moving too slowly to run a program like what Kai started. We do not have the ability to reward you financially for reducing your consumption at that time. We can't even add up all the results of what everyone's done. We don't have that capacity, but the utilities do, and they should run a program like it.
Right.
They're dabbling in that area, but let me give you a couple of fun facts. In the last 30 days or so, we've had this heat wave, an incredible heat wave. Electricity consumption in New England rose about 12% compared to last year, but the pollution over the corresponding time was up about 50%. And so there's a nonlinear relationship between our electricity usage and the pollution and the price. Don't even want to look at what it cost the grid, because we were using incredibly expensive fossil fuels, a lot of natural gas at a time when natural gas is exploding price-wise all over the world. Oil and coal has been burned in the last 30 days, which is awful. And right. So it's a nonlinear relationship. So when we really need to shave that peak and we need to try to levelize power demand as much right. as we can.
And I think it's a great program because it's very immediate in the sense that you get that text and you just go over and turn the air conditioner down a few degrees and you started to shave the peak, right? It's an action you can take that's almost painless. And that's great. The Green Energy Consumers Alliance, is that the URL? Green Energy yes. Consumers Alliance, one word, .org.
It's greenenergyconsumers.org.
GreenEnergyConsumers.org. Super. So, dear listener, check it out. It's pretty cool stuff. But Larry, beyond that, you track Rhode Island politics. So give me the story of, I guess, a multi-pronged question. What's unique about Rhode Island, right, in terms of addressing its energy needs? What's the state legislature trying to do, and how are they approaching the issue?
Well, I think we live in the greatest region in the country. I'm very parochial to New England. I live in Massachusetts, but I love Rhode Island and the other New England states. But Rhode Island's a little bit unique. It's the small size lends itself to the fact that if you're an energy person in Rhode Island, you probably know every other energy person in Rhode Island. It's like a large maybe a city. Whereas in Massachusetts, there's so many of us who are working on energy issues. So in Rhode Island, our staff have always been fairly known and influential, I hope, and I believe that to be true, because they get to know all the legislators who care about energy. They get to know all the industry people. They get to know advocates in other organizations. Like, we ally with groups like Audubon Society of Rhode Island and the Conservation Law Foundation. And so it becomes more of a interpersonal situation. So we end up having, I think, a fairly maybe disproportionate impact in Rhode Island as an organization. And so we tend to hire people who have that want and need to get to know everybody in the world. When the organization started, as I said, as People's Power and Light back in the day, there's a young guy named Eric Stevens who started that organization. He got to know everybody. And Karina Lutz was one of our advocates, and she got to know everybody. And we've had Kat Burnham work for us and got to know everybody. But Kai Salem in particular is now off to law school. She was just like a duck to water and was able to work in that field. Mal Skorin is also been a great advocate. She's unfortunately moving to California with family. But their ability to be subject matter experts and then to get to know the people that you need to know. And so 2022 was an extraordinarily impressive year for Rhode Island energy policy.
I would observe Green Energy Consumers is a pipeline of producing good people, which is a good thing all by itself. But tell me about what the what Rhode Island, you know, what the plan is in Rhode Island, what was so fruitful about the legislative session?
Well, what's interesting, so Massachusetts was one of the first states in the country, along with California and maybe one or two others, back in 2008, established a what's called the Global Warming Solutions Act. Environmental groups in Massachusetts and Deval Patrick as governor passed that law, which is one of the first in the country that said that emissions in the state had to go down every year until we got to essentially zero emissions by 2050. And so for a couple of years, we tried to make that happen in Rhode Island, and we finally did. And so a couple of years ago, there was a bill that had passed years ago in Rhode Island called the Resilient Rhode Island Act, which was didn't set requirements. It was aspirational. It said we have goals to reduce emissions, and we were never really satisfied with that. And so we worked together with other environmental groups. Our organization's part of a group of groups called the Environmental Council of Rhode Island, or ECRI. And so ECRI lobbied, made an act on climate their number one priority a couple of years ago. And that bill passed. And that is exactly what the doctor ordered, because that that an act on climate says that by 2030, emissions have to fall by 45% compared to a 1990 baseline, which is roughly equivalent. Massachusetts law says 50% by 2030. So but that's the right order of magnitude. That's essentially what the planet has to do to try to keep carbon dioxide levels from rising much further and having the temperature rise much further. And then it keeps going from there until we get to close to net zero, or at least 80% by 2050. And so that puts discipline on a state.
This is a mandated goal. This is not something they can shrug when they fail, right? They have to meet this goal.
Massachusetts actually failed to a few years ago to adopt to some of the requirements of the Global Warming Solutions Act, and the Conservation Law Foundation asked us if we would be a co-plaintiff with them, and we sued the state of Massachusetts and won in the Supreme Judicial Court, which essentially made the Commonwealth of Massachusetts write regulations that would actually be necessary to get the emission reductions we were looking for. And so that is what the Act on Climate in Rhode Island now enables. We can't do it until 2025, but at that point, if they fail to meet some of their benchmarks, the state of Rhode Island can be brought to court.
Is there an intermediate 2025 benchmark?
They have to start producing. There's several benchmarks that they have to meet. They have to right now. They're writing a plan.
Okay.
Then they have to start assessing limits. And if they don't do those things, then they would be subject to a challenge. The good news is, let's suppose that they comply with the law, that's going to cause emission reductions, but it doesn't tell you exactly how. So that what right now, the bureaucracy in state government in Rhode Island is working on a plan, just like Massachusetts has a clean energy and climate plan. That's what Rhode Island has to do. It's a little bit on the slow train because it's an election year. Gina Raimondo was the governor. She went off to be Secretary of Commerce for Biden. And so now we have Dan McKee, who is the acting governor. And in November, there will be an election to determine who the governor will be for the next term. And so because of that change, and some people have left the state energy office, I'm not sure the plan's going to get done very fast. But that plan will be important. But I think the plan is, it's kind of like, I've already seen that movie. They're going to write a plan that probably looks just like the Massachusetts plan. Mm-hmm. Massachusetts has a plan that's on the web right now, that's required by the Global Warming Solutions Act. It was just finished by Governor Baker's administration. And it's not a straitjacket, but it's a plan. And now if they comply with the plan, we should be able to reach our emissions. The plan by itself is not policy. So Rhode Island first needs to do the plan, but then it needs to adopt the policies. So what are some of the policies? That's what we're really interested in. So where 2022 is such a big year for Rhode Island, They went ahead and the legislature passed an incredible bill. 100% of the electricity to serve Rhode Islanders will be from renewable energy resources as early as 2033. And that is going to be the first in the nation.
That's fantastic.
We don't expect others. There could be a state or two that leapfrogs us before that. But so that puts a marker down. That's way ahead of Massachusetts and most other states. And so that's what we're excited about. So at least the electricity sector in Rhode Island is going to get much greener. And that will contribute a lot to the emissions that they need to reduce by 2030. Mm-hmm. And the way they're going to do it, it's a ratchet. Every year, the emissions from electricity are going to get cleaner because we're adding more renewable energy.
Is that a renewable portfolio standard kind of thing where a percentage has to be renewable every year?
Exactly. And the current, what they had as previous law was moving too slowly. Mm-hmm. And it was, I think it was going to be something like 38% by 2035. It was going up 1.5% per year, Ted. Now it's going to start jumping by about 8% per year.
8% per year?
Something. Yeah. Wow. And so it will be by, I forget what the number will be by 2030, but it'll be pretty high. And by 2033, it'll be 100%.
Well, if your retirement fund could grow at 8% a year, you'd be a happy camper, right?
Yes, so you would.
That's a good number, right? 8% a year growth in renewable energies is fantastic.
And that is going to cause new projects to be built. And in particular, the companion bill that passed that we're thrilled about is the legislature is requiring a procurement of 600 megawatts to 1,000 megawatts of additional offshore wind. Rhode Island already has a project under development called Revolution Wind, and it's offshore. It'll be built in a couple of years. And it's 400 megawatts. And so what's interesting about Rhode Island is it's a small state where the electricity demand isn't as big as Massachusetts, but it's got the same huge ocean resource. And so if there's any state in the country that could be served, get to 100% by using offshore wind and solar, it would be Rhode Island. And
you should brag on a little bit. I mean, Block Island. So Block Island, first of all, let me say, dear listener, Rhode Island is the most gorgeous shoreline in the world, right? It's almost like the Norwegian fjords with sort of this, all these sort of inlets and grassy, just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Block Island is an island off of Rhode Island and also beautiful. Fact that we may go there this month to visit, but off of that is the first offshore wind turbine in the wind farm in the nation, right?
Yes, there are 5 wind turbines of 6 megawatts each, 30 megawatts, and it's a sight to behold. But I forget which year those were built, but the technology has advanced so rapidly. The turbines that are going to be built for Revolution Wind and for these new projects, the next procurement will be double or triple in size. And so the one turbine will be able to produce so much more power.
It just tells you the progress. If the first one you put in the water was 30 megawatts, then the second one, I think you said 400 megawatts,
right? Right.
Then the third one's going to be between 600 and a gigawatt. I mean, that's remarkable improvement. And I guess I was saying how beautiful Rhode Island is because, I mean, there's wind, there's everything, there's the place to put this stuff. It is a great, you know, much as the shore of Massachusetts, I mean, a great wind opportunities. And Rhode Island would seem, because it's a small state, could satisfy its demand pretty quickly just based on wind, right?
Yes. So what's important, I want to point out that there was a study done. The former governor Raimondo commissioned a study by a group called the Brattle Group, and they did a report on how could Rhode Island get to 100% green electricity. And so it's a very well done study. It's still on the website of the Office of Energy Resources, and it laid it out. And it, you know, to oversimplify it, it came down to two basic things. The offshore wind can generate most of the power. And then solar. There's some good solar programs in Rhode Island that consumers can take advantage of. And the combination of these a couple of big wind projects, and then lots of solar. And there was another study done showing sort of estimating how much solar could be built in Rhode Island on developed property or brownfields. In other words, to try to avoid putting solar on open space if possible. Mm-hmm. So there's a pretty good solar resource in any state, including Rhode Island. And so that will be how Rhode Island gets to its 100%, primarily from offshore wind, solar, some onshore wind, and some anaerobic digestion from water sewer facilities, mm-hmm. things like that.
In Massachusetts, there's a lot of talk in sort of recognition of the opportunity for the state to become a leader in renewable, particularly wind, because of the nautical heritage, maritime. Does Rhode Island recognize that? Is there any parts of the bill that would turn Rhode Island into the, I don't want to, like, the Emirates of the wind turbine thing, a little tiny place that has outsized impact on wind industry?
Very much so. There's a commitment to, I think that the Rhode Island is going to invest something like $85 million into Quonset Point to make that a development hub. You know, mm-hmm. The turbines will be offshore, but they've got to have facilities onshore to stage things and whatnot. And I think what you're seeing in both states, and actually many other states up and down the Eastern Seaboard, are getting this. New Jersey and Maryland and Connecticut, Maine's beginning to look at it. The idea of the economic development opportunity is huge. Mm-hmm. And so even though Rhode Island is smaller than Massachusetts, I think Rhode Island will get its fair share of the economic development benefits. You know, pound for pound, Rhode Island's going to do very well by getting out there. And there's some friendly competition between the states. And because they want to be leaders, if there's going to be offshore wind, the facilities could be located in any one of the states. Probably all the states will have facilities that employ lots of people. It's going to be a great time to have, if you're a developer of somewhat industrial land on the coast, should step up. If you're an electrician or somebody who can work on a vessel, the next few years should be boom years for that type of person.
So just going down a historical path, my dad worked his essentially whole career at the Newport Naval Yards, right?
Oh.
And all of Rhode Island has the reason the Navy likes it so much is because there are all these deep water ports, right? You can bring big ships in. And dear listener, if you've never been to look at the Jamestown Bridge, so there's this enormous, gorgeous bridge that connects Jamestown, which is a relatively unpopulated island, but it's big enough to allow naval ships underneath it. And so the requirement for deep draft ships to bring in wind turbines or take wind turbines out or all that kind of stuff, Rhode Island's in a great spot to take advantage of that, which is really an interesting, I mean, it's kind of geeky, but it's a great place for Rhode Island to be sitting.
It is, you know, it's been unfortunate that New England for the last 100 years has basically been importing fossil fuels from all over the world and the country. We get our, coal, oil, and natural gas from, it's all either shipped here or piped here, trains used to bring in coal, right, for power plants. And so we ended up essentially exporting our dollars to import dirty fossil fuels. And that's turning around now. Now we will be able to keep our energy dollars in our states, and we'll be able to employ people from our states to build and maintain these facilities. And that's going to benefit us economically. All the studies that I have seen, the Brattle Groups and many others, Synapse Energy Economics and all that, is there's this thing called the multiplier effect. Is when you stop exporting your dollars and you keep them in, you end up growing the economy, you end up growing jobs. And right now, I got to toss in a reference to the war in Ukraine is causing primarily gas prices, but also oil and coal prices to rise, and tremendously so. Those are traded on the world market. And so Europe is paying a high price for gas. Japan's paying a high price for gas. That's causing power to be more expensive here in New England. And we're going to be starting to see that more. I know the emphasis in the last couple of months has been on gasoline prices and other prices at the supermarket. Those things are beginning to subside. But what we will be seeing in the next 6 months to a year is increasing electricity prices, not because of renewable energy, but because of natural gas.
Right.
And the point I want to make is the prices of the offshore wind projects that have already been approved in New England, Revolution Wind, Massachusetts has Vineyard Wind and Mayflower Wind, Commonwealth Wind, Connecticut has Park City Wind. You can look them up. They're all going to be much cheaper than what natural gas would charge. And that's before the war in Ukraine. And so I hope that that tragic event in Ukraine is a wake-up call to all of us, and that we can quickly realize that the only problem with offshore wind is it's not here yet.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, you're completely right. It's like when you start to think of it, once you put that wind turbine in the water, the fuel is free. And you're just paying a mortgage, essentially a mortgage on the cost of building it. But the fuel is free. Whereas if you stay linked to Putin in Ukraine, you're always subject to the whims of the market, right? And so, yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm with you.
And to go another point is with this winter's natural gas prices are going to be extraordinarily high. And heating oil prices, I think, are going to be very high too. The cool thing about wind turbines, when they're offshore, they're going to have what's called the capacity factor, the amount of potential power you can get out of a given wind turbine. And it is at its highest in the winter. Mm-hmm. And so when we think about how are we going to manage in the future, pretty nicely if we build enough offshore wind turbines. And there's a lot of promise in heat pumps.
Right.
Getting the natural gas or heating oil out of your home or business and heating with a high efficiency cold climate heat pump. Well, those do require electricity. The good news is if you love heat pumps, you'll love them even more because of offshore wind. The two go together like peanut butter and jelly.
That's great. So let me switch gears a little bit. You sort of metaphorically straddle the Massachusetts Rhode Island border, right? What if you look at the sort of the two states? I'm not sure how to phrase this. The two states as a unit or as relating to each other. Are there synergies that we should be thinking about how Massachusetts Rhode Island could work better together to? I think that Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut completely dominate the energy demand at the regional, the New England level, right? So if Massachusetts, Rhode Island, who consume most of the electricity that ISO, this is the independent system operator, ISO, the grid people, I mean, maybe I don't want to get hung up on grid stuff, but are there synergies that Massachusetts and Rhode Island should be looking at regionally?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple areas that are important. One is we're part of the New England Offshore Wind Coalition. And what we're talking about at that coalition is in order to bring in the immense power potential from offshore wind, we're going to have to build transmission lines. And we could go about it in a dumb way, or we could try to coordinate and, you know, kind of picture it as a big highway. And you'd want to build one road if you can, rather than three roads
and parallel roads.
And the economics of, we want to have economies of scale and you want to have the utilization high and all that. I'm not an expert on transmission, but what I think is going to happen is there will be an effort to coordinate transmission planning of offshore wind from the three Southern New England states.
Right.
So that could drive down the the cost of the power in the long run. And also, you know, with a little bit of planning, end up having fewer environmental impacts if we do it right as well. So I think that's an area. You know, there are some other areas we're working together. The states could be working together better, but they kind of collaborate a bit on energy efficiency work. Maybe they can create better policies that would drive down the price of heat pumps, which is our next big thing in the home energy efficiency world. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of discussion about coordinating among the states to build out charging infrastructure for electric vehicles. You know, I live in Massachusetts, and I really don't need a whole lot of public charging in my immediate area. I can charge at home. But what if I want to go to the office in Providence, or I go somewhere else in Rhode Island as part of my work or part of pleasure? I'd like to know that Rhode Island is building some charging stations that are publicly available. Likewise, people from Rhode Island coming to visit Massachusetts need to be aware of that, so of what we have to charge, so they can charge when they're on the road. Right. So, and you know, the Biden administration is trying to coordinate some nationwide electric vehicle infrastructure. And so I think that's a big piece for geographic regionalization.
Yeah. Super, super. So I guess well, I wanted to go back and review, remind everyone that Larry, you're from the Green Energy Consumers Alliance, executive director. This is a great organization. It offers all kinds of services to people to, we didn't even get into it, but I mean, it'll help you find a used electric vehicle. I think there's a program, right? There's all kinds of EV programs. There's a multitude of things that help you buy green electricity if you want. The website is greenenergyalliance.org. Say it again. Forget me. Correct me.
Yeah, greenenergyconsumers.org.
Okay, greenenergyconsumers.org. Of course, we'll put that in the show notes. But it's a great, it's a wonderful place to go visit. So, any last thoughts about the state of Rhode Island in terms of the future? We should be keeping an eye on things, right? Because you're headed in good directions.
Yep. Well, we're looking forward to seeing what the new governor is going to come up with. And that will be a big thing. The legislature, we think, has been excellent the last couple of years, right? With an act on climate, the 100% green electricity. We're talking to a few of them. They need to do more, though. They asked for it. They signed an act on climate. So we think in 2023, we're going to hope for some policies that get at reducing emissions from buildings, residential and commercial, which have not come down much in the last few years, and transportation. And so public transportation and electric vehicles and what we call active mobility. So we've already drafted a bill called the Electric Transportation Act that Senator DiMario and Representative Quartrand have filed in 2022. We'll try again in 2023. We're talking to Representative Kislak about a bill about building performance standards in Rhode Island. And so we'll keep at it.
That's great. Can I get extract a promise that you'll come back in 2023 and tell us about how things are going?
You know, Ted, I enjoyed this very much. And yes, you can take that to the bank.
That's super, super, super. So what we'll do is we'll put up links on the MCAN blog that refer to the show. You can get to the Green Energy Consumer website and some other stuff. There's interesting things there. That blog is at massclimateaction.org/blog. And if you go to the website, you search on the banner for newsletter, and then you find blog and podcast. It's kind of buried, but you can find it there. We want to thank our friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. I want to ask you to ask your friends to listen to the Climate Minute on their favorite modern podcast distribution app, because we're all over the place. Let that be your climate action for the week. And so, Larry, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. Really appreciate your insight. And I think we all know a lot more about Rhode Island now.
All right. Excellent, Ted. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.